Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Mark and Jamal's romantic weekend will depart in 4 minutes from Platform 6. Your ride comes with a rolling countryside sunset view and a table seat ideal for playing footsie beneath. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
Dr. Susan Landers is back today, and she is a natologist with over 30 years of experience caring for newborns, especially in the NICU. And she is also the author of So Many Babies and her newest book, Good Enough is Your Superpower. She has supported thousands of parents through some of their most vulnerable moments, and she truly understands what parents are navigating today. And Susan has brought a guest with her today. She is not alone in this conversation. And so these two beautiful humans are going to be discussing parents' concerns that they express to their pediatrician, questions and confusion about vaccines, and this woman's new book, Baby 411. And so, Susan, thanks again for being here. I'd love for you to introduce our guest, and I'm going to let you two talk, and I'm going to magically disappear. So welcome both.
Thank you, Lisa. Hello, everyone. I am delighted that my friend and colleague, Dr. Ari Brown, has joined me today. Ari is the author of the Baby 411 series of books that we'll talk a little bit about later. Toddler 411, 411 as well. Ari's a graduate of UT Austin. She went to undergraduate school here and then Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. She did her pediatric residency at Harvard, and she has been the owner and manager of 411 Pediatrics in Austin for over 30 years. She's very well-respected, a very popular pediatrician. Ari has appeared at medical meetings and conferences all over the country, and she often serves as a spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics. This is how much this woman matters to the field of pediatrics. She's not just writing books, she's teaching. She's been on the Today Show. She's been written up in the New York Times, other big media platforms. So I am just thrilled that Ari is here with us today. I invited her to talk about what parents are worried about and expressing to their pediatricians in the office. Is it just vaccines? Is it sleep? Is it behavior? Is it Where's Jessica? So I want to ask Ari what the main problem she hears today in her office from parents.
Wow. The main one? There are so many. We have so many options. Well, first of all, I have to say thank you so much for having me. This is a special treat. And what you didn't mention in the introduction is that I was actually one of your students. So I feel like we've come full circle when I was a medical student at Baylor and you were the neonatology attending on service. One of my inspiring pediatricians ahead of me. And then we worked together, you know, with patients that we've cared for over the years here in Austin. So it really is a special treat. But I will say, I think that if I had to pick one thing, and it's not going to be one topic, the one thing that I think parents struggle with is just the overwhelming amount of information that's available. And on the surface level, that would feel like a good thing because people can crowdsource and get information and, you know, do an AI search on just about any question they would have. But the difficulty is curating it and putting it in context. And actually, not everything that people see and hear and read is factual. And so that's where we come in as healthcare providers and as pediatricians, is to help people make sense of it all and actually tell them, well, these are the things that we worry about. And these are the things that you've got too many other things to worry about that you probably don't need to worry about.
Exactly. That's why I started my Moms Matter newsletter on Substack, because I wanted a place to really opine about what's going out there on social platforms, because a lot of it is misinformation. And it doesn't help that we have a Secretary of Health and Human Services that is very anti-vaccine and very anti-public health. And so no wonder parents are confused. They get most of their information from social media, not from classical news sources, not from their pediatrician. They get it from the internet and social media, and they're getting oftentimes bad information. They really are. One great example, I think, is vitamin K. Parents seem to be scared of giving a vitamin K shot to their baby after birth. I guess they think one little shot hurts too much. But vitamin K is just crucial for newborns to not have a hemorrhagic event. I have seen babies without vitamin K after birth who had a hemorrhage in their brain and suffered severe damage. So I guess I'm old-fashioned. I don't get why one little shot is a reason not to give your newborn something they're deficient in. Does that come up a lot for you, Ari?
Yeah. So I would say that I see children just a little bit later than you and your peers do. And back in the day when I first was practicing, probably for the first 10 or probably 15 years, I would make newborn hospital rounds. But even then, the vitamin K shot is given immediately after birth. And so that decision and that intervention has already happened even before I see my patient for the first time. So I don't interface on that level in that moment, although we do prenatal visits. And so, right. And I actually encourage every new parent to do a prenatal visit with their prospective pediatrician, because these are the questions that you should be asking about. If you have concerns, that is the time to talk right. about them, and not in the moment, because delivering a baby is exhausting. And so trying to make a decision in that moment without a clear head is not the right time to be having that conversation. So hopefully you've thought about it and learned about it ahead of that moment. But that said, yes, I do hear from my colleagues that that's becoming a big question mark and a discussion topic. And I think that you're right to be asking the core question is, what are people afraid of? It's a vitamin, right?
It's the vitamin, right?
Exactly. Which, you know, in our newfound embrace of wellness and longevity, people are looking for, you know, ways to optimize their nutrition, and it's a vitamin. So let's view it right. that way. But I think that the concerns that have arisen have been partially wrapped up in other things that are happening in that newborn period, including right. the hepatitis B shot. So that, I think, started the first series of questions for parents to be as well. You know, why do we give the hepatitis B shot to a newborn? Well, then why do we give a vitamin K shot to a newborn?
Exactly.
Why do we do right. eye ointment? Why do we need to do all of these things?
Yes.
And so people tend to be generally skeptical and questioning all of these medical interventions like it's some sort of a medical add-on or extra, which it's not. It's right. extremely important. So I think that, you know, the key points that parents need to hear, as you said, is that the reason why vitamin K is so important to a newborn is like 1 in 60 to 1 in 250 newborns are born with a vitamin K deficiency. And vitamin K is used to clot blood. And if you don't have enough vitamin K, you can have serious bleeding in the brain. It can be fatal. And this is not something we want anybody to experience, especially when it's so easily preventable. So I celebrate parents wanting to learn, and, you know, and I think it's important to not necessarily be skeptical, but wonder and be curious. But that's the reason why we do that. And I think that the other thing that has come up with respect to vitamin K, and feel free to chime in with your thoughts, is that there are other countries that do an oral vitamin K supplement versus a shot. And what we know is that the shot is much more effective in those early days.
Right.
And so that's why we have done it this way in the U.S., and we're not the only country that does that.
Yes.
But
yes.
It is superior. Tell me your experience or your...
The oral vitamin K takes about 2 to 3 weeks to give an average effect in the blood. So the baby is at risk during that time. And it's just, I think it's a non-issue. It's one little teeny shot. I want that leads me to the other issue for newborn parents is the hepatitis B vaccine. The American Academy of Pediatrics learned a couple of decades ago that if we treated all infants against hepatitis B, first shot at birth, then two subsequent shots, we could prevent chronic hepatitis B and hepatocellular carcinoma in some children. Now, babies only get hepatitis B from mothers who are excreting that virus at the time of delivery. And there was a time when we just screened the mothers and treated babies of mothers who were positive, but that did not turn out to be as effective as treating all newborns. And I'm really sad that RFK Jr. has muddied the water by telling parents the hepatitis B vaccine is not necessary in the newborn period, if at all. And I wanted to get your thoughts about the hepatitis B vaccine too.
I absolutely agree with all the things that you said. And again, I think parents are looking for, well, this is what the U.S. does. What do other countries do? And what I try to explain to people is it's very difficult to compare basically apples to oranges. And so some of the things that are different about other countries who have different recommendations is that they actually have universal health care. And that's not something that we have. And so one of the challenges in the United States is that we have a lot of women, and I think the number is at least 18%, who come to delivery without prenatal care. And so, yes, in a perfect world, it would be wonderful to screen everybody at the beginning of pregnancy. And I love it and celebrate it when we have families who get excellent prenatal care and they start from, you know, one as soon as they find out they're pregnant and they have excellent prenatal care and they're getting screened. Even that screening process does have some margin of error. But if you were able to screen everybody, your risk of that perinatal transmission of hepatitis B would be lower. But you are missing a large number of babies potentially at risk by having that approach. So we've learned, as you said, that we tried that. It didn't work in the U.S. We still missed a lot of kids. And this approach has been used since 1991, and it's been extremely effective. So, you know, you don't want to, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it, right? And so that's been such a frustration and outcry from the public health community. So many medical organizations who have all come out and said, this is not based on science. These conversations and all of this discussion is not based on science. We know that this has worked. It's been effective. We don't want to change course as a result of that. And it's not a disease that you want your child to have.
No. Chronic hepatitis B and hepatocellular carcinoma is a big deal. It's a huge, big deal. Chronic, awful illness. That takes me to another issue, and that is vaccination in general. I know you spend a lot of time talking to parents about whether vaccines are necessary. Measles is on everybody's mind because it's epidemic in certain states in the U.S. right now. Meningococcal infections are back. We had that eradicated years ago when we treated all teenagers with the meningococcal vaccination before they went off to college or when they finished high school. Are we going to wait until the polio recurs in the U.S. to do something about vaccinating children? Forgot to mention pertussis. Pertussis pops up all over the U.S. People are not getting their children vaccinated for pertussis. So what the American Academy of Pediatrics did, and Ari's well aware of this, is they stuck to the science-based immunization schedule that they had been advising parents to use for the last decade, at least decade and a half. And then RFK Jr. implied there were things wrong with that. And that confused a lot of parents. And he did not admit that the measles epidemic was a big deal. Measles is not a benign infection. Causes encephalitis in some kids. It causes pneumonia in some kids. It's very serious. And no one wants their child to go to school and sit next to a child who's not been vaccinated against measles and bring that virus into the classroom. So your thoughts about vaccines in general.
And so many thoughts based on all the things that you just said. So I think the first thing that I like to explain to families when we're having these conversations is, you know, it's okay to be curious. And again, I encourage people to be curious and ask questions because you're making really important decisions about your child's health. And so at your core, you're just trying to do the right thing as a parent. And so you should be able to have an open dialogue with your pediatrician. And you should feel like you can trust them as, you know, your true north to give you the source of information. Because at the end of the day, no matter how much you read and learn, it's very difficult to curate it. And that's what your pediatrician can really do. And we have these experiences that we cannot unsee. When I was at Baylor in medical school, that was during the measles outbreak in 91. Mm. I've actually seen measles. I'm one of the few pediatricians, like, I've seen measles, unfortunately, and it's horrible. I took care of a patient who died, who had chicken pox, taking care of whooping cough kids. So, you know, these are the things that shape our life experiences that we don't want parents and our patients to suffer through. And so the diseases are very real to us because we've seen them. And we also know how to evaluate data and read research. And science changes and recommendations are always evolving. That's what good science is, right? And so if there's something that indicates there's, you know, a safety risk or, you know, that's, we're going to change course. We're not going to just continue doing something. We're going to change course. And what we know, even when we keep looking at the research, and there's always new data and research, is that vaccines are safe and effective, and they prevent diseases that I promise you don't want your kids to have. And so that's why it's so important. And you're right that we don't live in a bubble. You know, if you're making another parenting decision, you know, you're going to buy organic milk or not, you make that own decision. You know, you decide. It doesn't impact anybody else, right? But you deciding that you're not going to vaccinate your own child, and then you put them into any situation that involves other children or adults who are immune compromised or people who can't get vaccines for a particular reason, then it puts other people at risk. So that decision doesn't happen in a bubble. So that's, and know that other people's decisions also protect your child. So this is, this is community immunity. And what we're doing is we're all helping all of our children when we make these decisions. So that's the framework that I use when I have these conversations with families. I would say, you know, respectful dialogue really matters. Conversations really matter. And at the end of the day, you know, your true north should be your pediatrician, somebody that you trust to be able to be the person who can put it all in context for you.
Right. In your practice, Ari, are you fielding lots of questions about developmental milestones and how do I know if my child has autism or some developmental problem? Does that take up a lot of time? You're shaking your head.
Yeah. And, you know, okay. So real talk, like I couldn't be more excited that families are so interested and so focused on their children's development. My undergrad degree is in child development. I did a developmental and behavioral pediatrics fellowship. I love, you know, watching kids grow and watching their developmental milestones and encouraging families and giving them ways to help promote and, you know, foster that development. So that said, I think that there has been a huge increase in interest because parents do understand that identifying early delays or atypical or different development is the first step to supporting children for what their needs are. And so that message has been put out loud and clear, and families are very focused on that. and they're tracking their kids' milestones, and they're concerned if their child hasn't hit a certain milestone. So yes, very much a hot topic. And what I would say, and this is something that I've learned, I mean, after practicing pediatrics for 30 years and seeing this evolution, is there's a word that's very buzzy right now that's neurodiversity. And so I actually don't like the term neurodivergent. I don't think people are neurodivergent or neurotypical. I think we have a continuum of neurodiversity, and kind of knowing where all of us are on that continuum, I think really is informative. Honestly, for how we're wired and how our loved ones are wired, and learning you're wired this way, and this is not going to go well with this, you know, interface because this is how I'm wired. I think that learning that and appreciating, you know, who you are and who your child is, who may be like you, by the way, which is always fun to kind of, as a parent, kind of has this self-awareness of, oh, I'm like that too. Oh, yeah. It's very telling. Anyway. So that, I think, is something that has definitely been more of a conversation topic, and really helping families spot some of those subtle early signs are really important.
Yes, yes. And I want to make a PSA announcement here. Taking Tylenol when you're pregnant does not cause autism. I don't know why our president and our Secretary of Health and Human Services said it did, because it does not. Lots of good scientists have studied autism. It's mostly genetic in families with one child who has autism spectrum disorder. The chances of having another child are 25%. So it's probably genetic. We see it a higher prevalence in babies who are born extremely low birth weight. So clearly environmental factors matter, but Tylenol during pregnancy is not one of them.
Agree. And if you need Tylenol, you should be able to take it with confidence.
Right, right. Yep. That's for sure. So I went to visit my 6-week-old granddaughter in Los Angeles last weekend, and she doesn't sleep very well during the day. She's a pretty good sleeper at night. She sleeps 4 or 5 hours. And I watched her parents doing this dance of her father held her over his shoulder and moved around and swayed and shushed and talked to her and sang to her, and the mother held her in the cradle hold and did all the other things. And I was just so delighted to see them talking to their baby, singing to their baby, moving with their baby, sharing feedings with their baby, sharing childcare, even at night. My son was taking a shift at night so his wife could rest, and she's pumping her milk, and they're exclusively bottle feeding, which was a mild disappointment for me. But anyway, the baby is being breast milk fed. And so their main focus was sleep for them and for the baby. And I know that comes up in your practice a lot.
Yes. I think that I always start out of the gate with telling families having realistic expectations is really important. A, so you don't feel so stressed, and B, so you don't feel like you failed. And so a newborn doesn't sleep. And when they do sleep, it tends to be during the day because their circadian rhythm is not there yet, right? And so that's pretty important. But people see all of these, you know, TikTok videos about how they got their baby to sleep through the night, all the secrets. And, you know, if there was a secret, if there was like a secret sauce, I would tell everybody what that secret was. Yes. I would say, I'll be very honest, and this is not, I'm not getting paid to say this. The closest secret sauce I have found is the snoo, and I'm friends with Harvey Karp, but he doesn't pay me to say that. I would say that my
patients snoo, do sleep. Right.
Yep, they do sleep slightly longer, which slightly longer is, you know, if you get an extra hour with, you know, a 6-week-old, that's like amazing. But it, I do think that they do sleep a little bit longer, truth be told. But the reality is they need to eat often. And, you know, they may sleep a lot, but never a long period at a time. And so there's a book called 12 Hours by 12 Weeks, and that's a complete lie. So please don't. You know, like if your kid is doing that, amazing, but don't tell anyone because no one will feel sorry for you.
Right.
So Yeah. So I always tell people, just, you know, let your newborn be in charge. They're going to do better. You're going to do better. Quit having unrealistic expectations. I love that your son is, you know, dividing and conquering is
yes.
so important for both parents, because I think you're, you know, quite honestly, you're a better parent if you're a little bit better rested. So dividing up the labor and getting grandma to come visit is super helpful if they would let you help, you know, like that. Really important.
I offered to do laundry. No, it's all done. I offered to cook. No, we've got it under control. I said, well, can I hold her a couple of times? It was pretty funny. So sleep training is such a hot topic.
Yep.
My older daughter, her children are now 9 and 5. She sleep trained one and the second one didn't need it because he was a better sleeper. And I've read so many books about sleep training, and I am just not convinced that it works. What are your thoughts about sleep training?
So I like to talk about it or frame it in the creating a healthy sleep routine. And babies, just like all humans, thrive on consistency and routine. And so for me, I think the first, you know, 3 months of life, that kind of fourth trimester, you have a baby whose nervous system is really immature and you do whatever you got to do to get them to fall asleep, which is usually, you know, feeding them till they fall asleep and having them up on your shoulder till they're dead weight. And then you peel them off in the hope they stay asleep when you transfer them into the bassinet and all those things. Like, that's every parent's toolbook, you know, or tool.
Right.
Yeah. Toolbox, but that works until it doesn't work. And so that's the point that I really try to instill in my family. So we talk about it, the 2 month well check is, I know this is what you're doing, it's fine. But around 3 months of life, what you want to do is separate those events. So you can feed your baby, but don't have them fall asleep while they're feeding. Or if they do, change their diaper and wake them up and then have a plan that's consistent with nap time and bedtime of, we read a couple of books, we sing a couple songs, we do some rocking, we're cozy, we're relaxed, but we're not asleep up on the shoulder or at the breast. Mm-hmm. And we're relaxed when we go into our sleep space. And so if you're consistent about that and you give them a little bit of a chance to fall asleep on their own, usually, you know, babies' nervous system 4 to 5 months, they can fall asleep on their own. They can self-regulate if you give them a chance. But if you don't try, essentially, you're the Uber to the land of Nod. And why would they ever wait in line for Hertz Rent-A-Car at the airport when the Uber is waiting for them? So, you know, don't be the Uber. Let them do it. They can drive. They've got their driver's license. Let them drive. So that's where I like to kind of create these healthy sleep routines. And then you don't have to sleep train, which, you know, has a negative connotation and has this whole cry it out kind of thing. Like, if you do it right, and then you're going to have setbacks, and then you have to kind of go back to, nope, this is what we do. And those setbacks are going to happen. You know, you're traveling, your kid is sick, you know, you're going to change the game plan, but then that becomes the new normal unless you reset. So you're going to have to do a little quick reset.
Right. Well said. I'm going to do a short commercial break here and share my screen. And can you see a picture of Ari's book, Baby 411, Your Baby from Birth to Age 1? I bought this book 2 weeks ago to give to my son and his wife. And I took it to LA. And then today I went, oh, I don't have the book to show. So here it is. Here it is, 11th edition. This is the Bible that parents need to get. Ari, tell us about Toddler 411 and Expecting 411.
So I started writing these books 2003. And so the baby book, first edition, came out in 2003. And we update the title every couple of years because medicine changes, guidance changes, policy changes. And so this 11th edition just came out in January. And coming behind it are the other two titles that I've updated this past year. So Toddler 411 7th edition comes out in May. And then Expecting 411, the 5th edition, comes out in August.
Awesome. Awesome. And I'm sure the books are available on Amazon. bookstores, Barnes and Noble, everywhere.
Wherever books are sold, we have an ebook version. We have an audiobook version if you want to hear the entire thing on audio.
Nice.
That's available too. Susan, you have to write an Amazon review if you bought a book. Thank you so much.
Oh, I will. And I went through and I annotated things. You have to read this part. You have to read this part. Because things that I had dealt with, well, after the fact, it wasn't out when my kids were little. So are you still getting lots of questions about behavior in children? And toddler tantrums, especially. Tell me about what's going on with toddler tantrums.
Yes. So again, I love the fact that parents are so interested in their child's development and behavior. And what goes along with that are all the parenting headaches and challenges that go along with it. And so toddlers, you know, their developmental job is to be independent and in control. And your job as a parent is to make sure they don't hurt themselves or hurt somebody else. And so those often will be in conflict with each other. And it may be the 20th thing that didn't go your toddler's way. They don't like the way they, you know, had their sandwich cut or you tied their shoes and they have a full blown meltdown. And so we, you know, as seasoned parents know what these temper tantrums look like. And you just hope it's not your kid and you hope it's not in the middle of the grocery store, right? But I have to say, it's been such an interesting place to be online because people, again, are looking for answers and positive parenting resources. And this whole Where's Jessica that came out a couple of weeks ago, I can't tell you how many people have asked me to weigh in on, does Where's Jessica work? And so if you haven't actually seen these videos, I encourage you watch them. But basically, the toddler is screaming and having a meltdown and the parent yells, Where's Jessica? And the kid stops crying and they're like suddenly looking for Jessica. And so it does work, and it works for young toddlers, I would say 12 to 24 months. And the real word for it is actually redirection, right? And so if you can redirect your toddler's attention to something else, then if it wasn't something that was the hill they're going to die on, they're probably okay with moving on, right? And so this has been something that a lot of parents have tried to see if it actually works. And I will say it does work. I would say it works for young toddlers. It's not going to work all the time. And as you have an older toddler or preschooler, I think it's actually important to notice that your child is visibly distressed and they're having an emotional moment. And it's really important to validate and give that emotion a name and then help them problem solve. Because at the end of the day, that kid needs help when they're having their tantrum because they're emotionally dysregulated. And so helping them find a way out of that is a really important life skill.
Right. Exactly. Well, I have picked your brain, not quite dry. Are there any other hot topics that are bothering you when parents bring it up? Are you frustrated by questions recently? Confusion maybe, or misinformation, other than everything we've talked about?
Wow. You know, I think that the major pain points of parenthood have, they're evergreen. And that's, you know, wanting to do the right thing and raise a, you know, a healthy, resilient child. And that, you know, it's the hardest job ever to be a parent. So that is unchanged. And we all have suffered through these pain points. But I think what's important to realize is at the end of the day, you have to trust yourself and know that there's a lot of chatter out there, but listen to your own chatter inside, because usually that's where the right answers are.
Yeah. And ask your pediatrician.
Absolutely. Yes.
If you don't,
if you're confused,
please ask your pediatrician.
Yes.
If you don't have a pediatrician, ask your family practitioner. They may not have the depth of knowledge about child health that pediatricians do, but if they don't know, they'll look it up. Any practicing physician, I think, is going to give you a better explanation than somewhere on the internet, somewhere on Facebook, somewhere on YouTube. You just, if it's a YouTube video put out by the American Academy of Pediatrics, let me mention healthychildren.org. The AAP has a beautiful website where parents can go to healthychildren.org. You can find information about any topic, up-to-date, science-backed, guidelines for parents, how to diagnose it, signs and symptoms. That should be your go-to place after you've looked it up in Baby 411.
Okay, well, I personally thank you for the shout out, and I'm sure that the AAP will also thank you for that shout out because they are a wealth of information for
families. Yeah, right. Okay, well, this has really been a pleasure. Thank you for spending your afternoon with me and the moms that are listening. The moms that listen to my podcast are very interested in burnout, and I figure if you're doing anything with an infant or a toddler, it can be a trigger towards burnout, especially if you're working like most mothers are these days. So all these topics that we talked about are important for moms to feel really good about, that they have a good understanding, that they know where to go for information. So it makes them worry less. Having less stress in your life is the way for a mother who is working to enjoy her infant and her children. Clearly, less stress is better. And I hope that we answered your questions and entertained you a little bit this afternoon with this podcast. Thanks, Ari.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Yeah, has been.